and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the accidental release of evidence that Robert Mueller has, which many see as a bombshell, in as much as it establishes that, contrary to Trump's persistent claim that Paul Manafort's illegal activities happened before he was hired to run the Trump campaign, now it is clear that Manafort was supplying campaign polling data to a Russian link to the GRU, a foreign adversary's military intelligence service, which blows away Trump's other claim that there was no collusion. Harry Litman, a former United States attorney and deputy attorney general in the Justice Department, who is currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, joins us to discuss the significance of this new revelation. We'll examine the possibility that Manafort was either cooperating with the Kremlin or was owned by Putin's close friend and powerful oligarch Deripaska, who was leaning on Manafort to pay back debts, and the coincidence that the Trump campaign's private polling data appears to fit neatly into the hacking of the Clinton campaign that the GRU was engaged in, and the targeting of Americans in the important swing states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin with social media messaging carried out by the trolls hired by Putin's chef at the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg. Then, with Trump pulling off another reality TV stunt today by walking out of a meeting with Chuck and Nancy, we'll examine the looming prospect that tomorrow, Thursday, when he visits the border, Trump will declare a national emergency. Azeez Huq, a professor of law at the University of Chicago who clerked for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of How to Save a Constitutional Democracy, joins us to discuss how it appears Trump is poised to take a radical action, which unfortunately he can do. We will explore what constraints the Democrats could employ to stop this unwarranted authoritarian ploy. Then finally, we will speak with Will Bunch, an award-winning senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, where his latest article is U.S. National Emergency Law, A Disaster Waiting for a Demagogue. We will look into how despots like Erdogan, General Sisi, Maduro, and Hitler have used declarations of emergency to end democracies, and how one day ahead of the Friday deadline for government workers to get their paychecks, Trump could declare his national emergency to get the Pentagon to build his wall, then, with that off the table, call for the Democrats to reopen the government. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney General appointed by President Bill Clinton and also a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who is currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Litman.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be back.
Well, thank you, Harry. And it seems to me this accidental release by, by Manafort's attorneys of some of the court documents involved in Mueller's inquiry would indicate that the two pillars, as I mentioned in the opening, the two pillars of Trump's persistent and consistent claims that there was no collusion and that Manafort's bad behavior all happened before he hired him as his campaign manager, because he doesn't say why he hired him if he had all this terrible record, but that's beside the point. So now it seems to me, at least to my mind, that both of those claims of Trump's have been deeply undercut by this new revelation,
if not demolished. It seems the same to me, Ian. And I think these are sort of blockbuster events that would have been treated as such, but for the focus on Trump's wall in the last few news cycles. But look, you know, from a base of criminal activity in Russia, which Mueller began to charge and prove about a year ago, to the revelation of some criminal activities in the United States, Mueller is now building a bridge. And these are two very strong connections two very strong cables on the bridge. First, as you say, the provision to Kilimnik by Manafort of polling data, you know, what could that possibly be about? It's barely conceivable, I guess, that it was just to give folks in Russia or Kilimnik and Deris Paika, who we owed a lot of money to, their jollies. But it makes much more sense, as you suggest, that it was somehow to be used by the Russian sophisticated social media trolling operation to know whom to target, how to target, and the like. And that's exactly what a full-on partner in a campaign would do. And then second, we now know that the lawyer in the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting, Natalia Veselkovnaya, it was, in fact, and is, in fact, an agent of the Russian government. And so when she is offering dirt on Hillary Clinton, which she famously did, and Trump Jr. said, if that's what it is, I love it, it seems, again, a connection, a link between the campaign that, and the, at the highest reaches, and the Russian government, not stray Russian actors. So if what you're clamoring for is tangible indication of an actual coordination to help the Trump campaign, this is probably the strongest evidence yet. And we also have had in the last 24 hours revelation in that Manafort was talking about the Ukraine so-called peace plan with Kilimnik, and that gives a suggestion of what was in it for Russia, the possibility of the United States supporting some kind of grand process in Ukraine, sort of rolling Ukraine, and putting the Russians in the driver's seat again, but without the sanctions that had ensued from the original installation of the Russian puppet president. So this just seems to me like two sides pulling on the same oars together, and in concert with the dual aim of getting Trump elected president and richer still on the one hand, and having Russia have its sort of imperial ambitions or world power ambitions furthered.
Well, Konstantin Kilimnik is rumored to be a former GRU officer, and he was Manafort's deputy in Ukraine for many years when Manafort was doing basically propping up Putin's puppet there, Yanukovych.
That's right.
Who was driven out by the people. And there's some suspicion, in fact, it's more than a suspicion, that when Yanukovych was murdering his own fellow citizens in the Maidan as they protested, Manafort was there by his side, urging him on. So, you know, I'm beginning to wonder how much Manafort was owned. We know he was owned by Deripaska, and whether that was a ploy to get him hooked on Deripaska's money, and this guy's got more money than God, or whether he knew that he was going to squander it or not, I don't know. But $20 million went missing, and he was obviously afraid of Deripaska. And I think any reasonable person would be afraid of Deripaska. In the aluminum wars, when he took over the aluminum monopoly in Russia, and by the way, the U.S. Treasury Department just relieved sanctions on him for mysterious reasons. Clearly, the U.S. government files indicate that he may have killed up to 42 people in the aluminum war. So he's not a character you want to cross.
Well, he's clearly not that. And I think we've known for some time that simply the $20 million debt was enough to both petrify Manafort and motivate him to do the work he did. From just Manafort's position, it looks pretty clearly that what happened is, desperate for money and not being otherwise in a position to pay it back, he approached the Trump campaign and offered to work for free as campaign manager with the notion that he would somehow be able to give some payment in kind to a very prominent Russian with ties to the government as well. So just that situation is already ripe for outsized influence on the Trump campaign. And it, as it came to pass with Manafort specifically, for instance, in the alteration of the Republican platform to be tougher on Ukraine. Now the question becomes what from Manafort gets passed on to Trump and why? And the same kind, you know, kind of head-scratching questions pertain to Trump. It seems so implausible, and yet he repeatedly seems to act like someone who's been is under the influence and maybe even the leverage of Putin and Russia. And what could explain that or explain his conduct is maybe the $64,000 question here. But certainly Manafort would be a central figure, however you slice it, that we know clearly that he was doing everything he could to serve the interests, not even of the campaign, and certainly not of the country, but of his, you know, saving his skin and trying to work off a huge debt to a very scary customer, as you say.
And again, I'm speaking with Harry Litman, who's a former United States attorney and deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, who's currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. I've spoken to Swedish diplomat Anders Aslin a few times. He was spent a lot of time in Ukraine, knows Yanukovych, knew Manafort when he was working there with Kilimnik, knows Kilimnik. And he pointed out to me that there is no way that Manafort, since he was given the account to do all the media for Yanukovych's re-election, or election, I should say, that Manafort wasn't working for Putin because he was doing Russian language media as well, not just Ukrainian media. He was targeting the pro-Russian part of Ukraine with his campaign for Yanukovych. And so that's, I thought that was a very revealing point. You know, you don't get to do that kind of high-level work for the Kremlin unless you're working for them. I mean, you know, it's just, this is not freelancing.
Yeah, without their express blessing. Now, look, there could be a couple of things that means to work for them, but there's no doubt that Manafort for many years was a criminal soldier of fortune working the mines in Ukraine and Russia. That was his job description. Now, in that sense, he certainly is enthralled to Putin and he couldn't be operating as he was without Putin's at least tacit blessing. That's my understanding as well. Now, is there some other way he's enthralled that leads to a more desperate straits? And I think the first thing you would look to there is the huge debt he was in. We now see him, I think, as a broken, desperate figure. You saw his lawyers filing papers yesterday talking about his depression and anxiety and gout and all of the rest. You can only imagine when the situation first presented itself of this huge debt that he couldn't pay back and he was at wit's end to figure out what to do, that the campaign's position came at him as a godsend, and he was not only willing, but the whole point of the taking of the job was to be able in some way to pay back or provide to important people in Russia a information or other things that would make up for his personal debt. I mean, you see this as you would see like a luckless gambler whose debt has come due to a mobster and is going to either come up with the money one way or another or get his knees broke. And basically, Manafort has had his knees broken by now the U.S. government and life in general, and seems like a completely deflated soul. But yeah, at the center of the Trump campaign, the manager itself was a dynamic that was all about pleasing a hostile power. That on its own is kind of breathtaking.
Well, all of this is pretty much made clear in this accidental, unredacted material that came out on Tuesday from Manafort's lawyers. So it's pretty clear.
And some have suggested, by the way, I don't buy it, but some have suggested that it was actually not only meant to appear inadvertent, and they wanted to put it out there. I don't see it, and I don't think a lawyer could participate in that kind of malfeasance. But just reading, not reading between the lines, but reading the lines itself, it's very damning. I mean, again, he's not serving Trump directly. He's certainly not serving anything American. He is, you know, serving himself and Russian, you know, patrons who more or less own him.
And on top of giving Kilimnik all of this important information, because why it's so relevant is that there's no way in the world that polling information given by the campaign would be what would be readily available to the Russians, because they would have access to that. So this was clearly material that they couldn't get. So that's why I think
that's really true. You can only surmise that the reason they wanted it was to turn around and feed it to their very sophisticated operation that was doing this illegal kind of trolling campaign. And if that was in coordination with the Trump, well, it obviously was in coordination with the Trump campaign. If it was in coordination with Trump, you have a easy to prove criminal conspiracy. But I'm at a loss to figure out why they would want it other than for that purpose. It seems to me most likely wanted to do it to help Trump, and in that sense they look like almost subcontractors in a campaign. You would hire people in the United States to try to use and analyze and leverage this kind of information, and I don't think the Russians needed it just to have a sense of who was going to win.
Well, it also, of course, in the accidentally unredacted material that came out yesterday, Manafort says, and I hope this makes me whole with Deripaska.
Right.
You know, so it's pretty clear that he was that specter of having his kneecaps broken was still there. So then just in the last couple of minutes, and this is beginning to explain, I think, in a way, the peculiar behavior of Manafort, where he makes a deal with the special prosecutor, then lies with him. After he made his proffer, he lies, which is a huge no-no. What do you think's going on with this guy? Was he afraid that the Russians would get him killed in a prison in the U.S.? Is he angling for a pardon? Was he trying to hide the fact that he might well be a full-on agent of the Kremlin?
Which a lot of people have speculated, and they've suggested that he prefers the safe confines of a federal prison to the possibility of a stray needle in Central Park. I find my best sense of him now, I mean, he seems, when you see him and read him, utterly broken and pathetic kind of figure. And I see that possibility, the sort of John le Carré idea. My better guess is that he's just a completely down on his luck former swashbuckling gambler who just has no confidence anymore and has veered back and forth very imprudently, right? I mean, in that situation, what you would want someone to do is pick your poison, take it, and, you know, are you going to cooperate with Mueller? Are you going to aim for the pardon, but not go back and forth? So the suggestions that maybe he's a Kremlin agent, to me, have always provided no real answer to, well, why then did he decide to cooperate in the first place and go through this sort of faux cooperation and only to lurch back? I just think he's a mess. He's, you know, feels he's maybe going to die in prison. He thinks he wants to try to show loyalty at the end of his life, or at least not be a squealer. But he has gone back and forth and just pursued inconsistent strategies. that I understand is not a fully satisfying explanation, but we're dealing in implausibilities, because any way you slice it, his conduct for a pardon, for Russia, for Mueller, has been irrational and imbecilic, because he's wound up kind of not being in anybody's favor.
Well, Harry Lipman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, always good to be here. Thanks very much, Ian.
Thanks a lot, Harry. And again, I've been speaking with Harry Lipman, who's a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who's currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how it appears that Trump is poised to take a radical action on the border by declaring a national emergency.
Having hard time in this crazy town. Having hard time. Have no love to be found. Having hard time in this crazy town. Having hard time. Have no love to be found. So many hard times.
Come on.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Aziz Huq, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He was a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Powers in a Time of Terror. And his latest book, co-authored with Tom Ginsburg, is How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Huq.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And I feel as if there's some kind of crisis looming here in terms of the possibility that the president, perhaps even likelihood that the president on Thursday, when he goes down to the border, might declare a state of an emergency. It seems like he's running out of rope. And today he pulled yet another reality TV stunt and walked out of a meeting with Chuck and Nancy, as he calls them. I just read his tweet. Just left a meeting with Chuck and Nancy, a total waste of time. I asked what is going to happen in 30 days if I quickly open things up. Are you going to approve border security, which includes a wall or steel barrier? Nancy said no. I said bye-bye. Nothing else works. So do you think he's laying the groundwork for pulling the trigger on a state of emergency?
I think that there are very few options that politically Trump can pursue, given where we are in negotiations with the House and Senate Democrats. It appears that by ratcheting up the ante, he has raised the specter of repeated shutdowns as a mechanism for achieving his policy ends in the face of a hostile House of Representatives, in a way that makes it quite implausible for the Democrats ever to yield to his demands for the wall. So I don't see how his strategy ends in any kind of success for him, which means that the only exit route, particularly given his declining popular support as shown by polls in the last week, I think his only exit route is the declaration of an emergency and the redeployment of military to build a wall on the southern border.
Well, I did an interview the other day, I think it was on Sunday, with Elizabeth Goitein at the Brennan Center, and she's looked into the issue in depth of what national emergencies involve in terms of expanding presidential powers. And I don't know whether you read the article, her article in The Atlantic, Aziz Huq, but it's pretty alarming the extent to which this president, who already has sort of autocratic predilections, if you will, is about to assume enormous powers. And is that, talk about checks and balances, is there any...
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And this is a long-standing problem. And in fact, the statute that he would invoke, the National Emergencies Act, was passed in 1986 as a way of consolidating and limiting the plethora of emergency power statutes that had been placed on the books in the 1960s and 1970s, right? So the problem is one of Congress's over-eagerness to punt hard questions to the executive, particularly around exigent or sudden action. This over-eagerness takes the form of enacting multiple statutory emergency powers, right? This has been a problem since the 50s and 60s, as I said. The effort in 1986 with the National Emergencies Act to tamp down upon this range of emergency powers hasn't succeeded. Congress keeps adding to the president's statutory emergency powers, with the result that as Liza Goitein has shown in her study with the Brennan Center, there's some 123 statutes today that, once triggered by the president, authorize one kind or another of extraordinary action. Right? We've already seen one of those provisions play out early in the Trump administration. It was the statutory provision in the immigration law that Trump relied upon to effectuate his Muslim ban.
Well, I think that at this point, the U.S. is currently operating under 28 active national emergencies. And I think prior to Donald Trump, Barack Obama, I think, instituted 12 national emergencies. So, but what's the difference between some of these national emergencies that Obama instituted and that are still apparently ongoing? How many of them are related to weather events and other things like that?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any statistics on the breakdown of the Obama emergency declaration, some of which had to do with foreign policy events, right, that I think are more plausibly described as emergencies that, at least within the meaning of the statutes. The effect of any kind of emergency declaration, either tomorrow while Trump is at the border or the other time to be vigilant is late in the news cycle on a Friday evening, is I think uncertain, right? I think that this will really be an emergency under, I think, one of two potential statutes that allow for the diversion of funds for new construction projects that would be relatively targeted at the creation of this of whatever kind of wall or fence that he's hell bent on.
So that is likely to involve the military, right? There are pots of money over in the Pentagon. So he has the right to divert these pots of money. And does he have also the right to turn our soldiers into construction workers?
Well, I think there will likely be a legal challenge both to the invocation of emergency powers. I think that there will be an argument that the statutes in question don't apply in this situation. And I've looked at those statutes briefly, and I can see arguments both ways. I also think that there will be arguments of the kind that Bruce Ackerman has already raised in the pages of the New York Times about statutory limitations going back to the Posse Comitatus Act on the authority of the president to call the military into the domestic sphere to accomplish tasks that are not war or combat related. So I can imagine a lawsuit being filed very quickly, either by a landowner close to the projected construction sites of the wall, or by some organization or not-for-profit that represents the interests of represents either environmental interests, which would be affected by the wall, or the interests of migrants, challenging the legality under the relevant federal statutes of any kind of emergency declaration and consequent construction project. And I think that we would likely see a long, drawn-out legal fight where the very complicated details of the statute would quickly get lost. I find it very implausible to think that the president has personally sat down and closely examined these statutes, and which would drag the courts into the limelight of national politics in yet another unpleasant and needless way.
So what will the courts do? I'm hearing that the courts don't really want to challenge a president's right to declare a national emergency. I mean, it is his right. The question here is whether it's justified, and that, of course, is a huge question. And you have
I think there's two things that you can imagine happening. I mean, one thing is that plaintiffs could challenge the existence of the emergency. I think on that point, they're likely to lose. Courts are not inclined generally, and certainly not at present, given the partisan composition of the courts, to second guess the quality of judgment about the existence of an emergency. But I think the more likely to prevail challenge would focus upon the existence of the relevant conditions, the relevant triggers for the declaration of an emergency. Statutes that create emergency powers generally say the president can do X if X and Y have occurred and the project to be undertaken has the following characteristics. And I can imagine a plaintiff coming in and saying, wait, no one thinks that X and Y triggers have been identified, and no one thinks that building the wall, as the president wants to do, actually falls within the description of what these emergency powers allow. And I think those kind of challenges are likely to be the ones that are going to get more traction if and when this goes to court.
But Aziz Haq, by nature, an emergency is time-sensitive. And I don't understand how you could declare an emergency on the southern border to build a wall that could take 2 years at least, I would think. It'd be a miracle if they did it in 1 year. So how do you justify a year or two-year-long emergency?
It would be nice if Congress had written emergency statutes to put time limits on the emergencies, precisely for the reasons that you say. But many statutes are written so that the emergency is capable of being described as open-ended. Indeed, the statute under which the travel ban has proceeded is akin to an emergency powers provision, and it imposes no constraint in terms of time on the duration of extraordinary limits on certain nationalities' entry into the United States.
Well, let's walk our audience through, assuming tomorrow that on the border that President Trump declares a national emergency, what is the next step? If the Congress is giving him these powers and he has the power to declare a national emergency, do they just have to rubber stamp it, or can they just say, well, this is a, you know, justify it under whatever statute?
I think there's a couple of different pathways that we might see. The original version of the National Emergencies Act had within it, and many other emergency powers statutes had within them, something called a legislative veto, which was a mechanism which allowed one house of Congress to repudiate an action that was taken by the executive branch under a given statute. And legislative vetoes were introduced in the 1930s as a way for Congress to exercise some control, even after it had engaged in a delegation of power to the executive branch. But the Supreme Court in the 1980s, in a case called Chadha, invalidated legislative vetoes, said that these were contrary to the separation of powers. And so the only response that Congress can engage in with respect to an invocation of emergency powers that's legally effective is to pass a new law. And of course, that requires either the signature of the president or a supermajority of both houses, which I think you're not likely to get either in the House or the Senate. So there's very little opportunity for an effective congressional response. You might see resolutions of disapproval from the House, perhaps even from the Senate, but it's hard to think that those are going to move President Trump. So given the inability of Congress to legally prevent this from unfolding, that's why I think you're much more likely to see action in the courts.
But is there in the broader zeitgeist, in terms of the public, in public opinion, and I think a lot of people thought that President Trump's Oval Office address was, well, first of all, he sent out fundraising appeals before and after the address, and he started out being a little presidential and then suddenly got into his campaign mode and listed all of the best lines from his many rallies about how terrible and dangerous brown people are. So that was pretty much the way it came across, I think. He said it was fantastic and everybody loved it, but I don't think that's the case. So is there a quality here of crying wolf too often, do you think? That there's just no external justification for this. Will it fall under its own weight? Is that possible?
It's very hard to tell how public opinion shapes the options that this or any other president has. Public opinion now is tending against the president. In late December, under 50% of the population blamed the president for the shutdown, and about a third blamed the Democrats. Polling from the last week or so suggests that the number blaming the president has ticked up by 2 or 3 points, and the number blaming the Democrats hasn't really changed. Right? So overall, I mean, given that we're a very partisan, polarized country today, the PR battle seems to be going against the president, at least with respect to the shutdown. And more interestingly, or more relevant perhaps to your question, the number of Americans who perceive a crisis at the border of the kind that the president has been talking about, not just yesterday, but more generally, is quite low. And in one survey that I saw, it was about 12%. It's not clear that anyone who wasn't already predisposed to view migration, and particularly migration of people of color or different ethnicities, as a crisis, is being persuaded. But it's also not clear that the president's claims of crisis are doing all that much to his authority. I think he would have to be really inattentive to American politics to come to the table today expecting this particular president to engage in persistently truthful rhetoric, right? If you're shocked by his exaggerations or untruths yesterday, then gosh, where have you been for the last 2 years?
Well, I refer to the president's governance, if that's not too generous a description, as government by stunt. And it does seem that he does run a kind of reality TV show out of the Oval Office, and it's very difficult as a journalist to cover it because you implicitly feel that you're being manipulated. And I just wonder, does that translate to the rest of the country? In other words, constant crises moving from one to the other as the initial crisis fizzles. It's certainly no way to run a railroad, but I'm wondering about, again, the people in the base, at what point would they start questioning I know there's been a very consistent job done over the decades to demonize government itself, and that's been a Republican project. But, you know, when you got all these government workers out of work, and the president, of course, never mentioned the cafe last night. He never mentioned that the government was shut down, and it never even came up. He talks about the war, but not about the government shutdown. That's impacting the lives of a lot of people, and I think it doesn't seem like he cares too much about that. But surely when people start not getting their tax refund checks and et cetera, won't it change?
You mean won't his popularity change?
Well,
I think it depends upon who gets blamed for the shutdown. I mean, for example, TSA workers are predominantly Republican supporters, right? I think we know that just empirically. And yeah, maybe they all blame the Democrats. I think you're clearly right that the shutdown is already and will increasingly have serious economic effects for federal workers who depend upon their salaries, for the people who depend upon federal services. The president has shown absolutely no sign that he even knows of or cares about these effects. I think under normal conditions, that indifference or apathy would be a serious strike against a politician who held elected office. You know, this president has shown himself to be beyond embarrassment about lots of different things, and regrettably, this doesn't appear to be all that different.
Well, Aziz Haq, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
No, thank you for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haq, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And his latest book, co-authored with Tom Ginsburg, is How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into how a U.S. national emergency law is a disaster waiting for a Democrat, waiting for a demagogue.
I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware the South is yours. Oh, 1984. Oh, see, come see, remember me.
Baby, all my moving road. You said it would last, but I guess we grow in 1984.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Will Bunch, who's an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he blogs at attitude.com. That's spelled attitytood.com. He's the author of Tear Down This Myth, The Right-Wing Distortion of the Reagan Legacy. And his latest article at the Philadelphia Daily News is U.S. National Emergency Law, A Disaster Waiting for a Demagogue Like Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Bunch.
Yes, Ian, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And Justice Jackson referred to the National Emergency Law going back to Korematsu, of course, the infamous internment of the Japanese, as FDR's left his successors in the Oval Office a loaded gun. Well, I think tomorrow, Thursday, Trump is going to pick up that loaded gun at a photo op on the southern border and declare a national emergency. What do you think?
It's possible. I mean, he did state earlier today that he still considers that an option for bypassing Congress and getting the money, moving it around within the federal budget and getting his $6 billion for the border wall. Yeah, I think that's a very real possibility. Will he do it tomorrow? I think, you know, there was a lot of talk that he wanted to do it in his speech to the nation on Tuesday night, and his advisors talked him out of it. I mean, I think there's a legitimate concern that exceeding his authority could be seen by the Democrats in the House is yet another possible ground for impeachment. So it's a fascinating situation. You know, as you mentioned, we've been debating the emergency powers of a president certainly since World War II and really since the Great Depression and the New Deal. I should note that Congress attempted to update all of this in 1976 with the National Emergencies Act of 1976. So we are under kind of a different regime than we were during World War II. But despite that new regime and despite what was supposed to be congressional oversight that was put into the bill, the potential for abuse is still enormous.
Well, that's, I think, what your article is pointing out, you know, that Erdogan, who Turkey's despotic ruler who Trump admires, he declared an emergency after the failed military coup, and the state of emergency still exists. Egypt, of course, has a state of emergency. Venezuela has a state of emergency, and so does Nicaragua. And the most famous, of course, you point out, is the Article 48 of the German Constitution, which was invoked by Hitler, leading to his rise to power in 1933 after the infamous Reichstag fire, which clearly the Nazis set. So those are some of the historical examples. So it's bad enough that Trump's declaring a national emergency as a political stunt. I mean, he pulled off a political stunt today, walking out on a meeting with Schumer and Pelosi, and that's what he's doing. And I'm sure as a journalist, you feel somewhat caught, as I do, that covering this guy. You know you're being manipulated on a daily basis. It's all about the politics of distraction. But it seems to me that this whole border thing is all about the politics of distraction. And now he's got to gin up a justification for this by creating a crisis when none exists. So what's the distance in your mind between Trump's latest political stunt, which is like it happened tomorrow, at least in my mind, and the Erdogans and all of these other examples you give in your article?
Yeah, I think, you know, and I want to make clear, I mean, you know, I, like a lot of political writers, I kind of hate the term optics. I think it's overused, but maybe it actually does apply here. That just the optics of declaring a national emergency or state of emergency, when you think about what this term has meant throughout history to everybody from Erdogan all the way back to Hitler and other despots who've used these types of powers to go, in many cases, from being a democratically elected leader to becoming a despot, a dictator. And so it is alarming. And I do think on a certain level that you're right, Ian, that it is, you know, politics of distraction, because I think what he desperately is trying to do is, I mean, he feels that the one way he can really cling to power in an increasingly worsening situation is to hang on to his base. And he knows that nothing energizes his base like xenophobia, you know, anti-immigrant rhetoric and anti-immigrant actions, if possible. He was actually seemed to be in December on the brink of keeping the government open without the money for the wall. He signaled he would sign a bill that would do that. And what happened is he got pressure from the real true base of the Republican Party, which is talk radio and Fox News. The hosts of Fox and Friends, Rush Limbaugh, Ann Coulter, people that Laura Ingraham, all of those people accused Trump of backing down if he signed this bill without the wall. And because of that, he did a flip-flop, and now the government's been shut for 18 days and counting, and there's really no end in sight. I mean, you know, I guess if he does do this national emergency maneuver tomorrow or in a few days, I guess the quote good news, unquote, is I guess they technically could reopen the government. The bad news is just seeing a president invoke dictatorial type powers to bypass the other branches of government. I don't think it's worth reopening the government to basically lose our democracy.
So Friday, by the way, of course, is a significant day. That's when federal workers stop getting their paychecks. So Trump, by the way, in his broadcast last night, which was largely a campaign speech, and he did send out fundraising requests before and after his speech. One wonders now in retrospect why the big networks were rolled by Trump to give him this platform. But that's already done. But it seems that given that he's on the, I think he's running out of maneuvers, and Friday would be a significant day. He didn't mention the shutdown once. Not. It's all about the war.
No. I think Speaker Pelosi and Senator Schumer were right to put the emphasis largely on that. I think we're really, in the last day or two, we're really seeing just the increasing potential for mass chaos.
Right.
Here, you know, as this government shutdown continues, you know, more TSA workers walking off the job, you know, farm workers who are supposed to be helped out because of the Trump tariffs not getting that help, people potentially not getting food stamps or other social welfare benefits that they're entitled to.
Or IRS refunds.
Correct. So you're really talking about... You're talking about every segment of society, you know, from affluent people who travel around the country by airline to struggling people who really depend on that safety net of food stamps and other government programs. You're really talking about every citizen starting to be affected by this. And it's just chaos, you know. I mean, it's almost funny because, you know, when Trump was elected president 2 years ago or 2 years and 2 months ago, the nightmare scenario was that he would be such a bad president that the nation would descend into chaos. And 2 years later, it seems to be happening. It's truly remarkable. And we'll have to see. You know, I have to say that it's hard to be hopeful in these situations, but, you know, we are seeing more and more Republicans, I think, willing to break from Trump, certainly on this issue. And I'm thinking even maybe perhaps more broadly, you know, between Syria, which is a whole convoluted situation that I want to get into, but, you know, between what's going on at the Pentagon and now the government shutdown, disagreements over immigration, when you're seeing more and more Republican senators, I think, willing to not, and some House members as well, not wanting to back Trump on everything. And, you know, I mean, that this type of erosion, if it continues over the coming weeks, could be fatal to his presidency.
Right, and he's already setting a terrible example by using this kind of extortion to get his way over the Congress. And whether they're Republicans or Democrats, as an institution, they ought to recognize that this is no way to run a railroad, that every time this guy has a tantrum, he shuts the government down in order to get his way. That's not the normal order of business.
No, I think to their credit, I think there are some, I think probably most Republicans deep down inside realize that it's no way to do business. What you need to see is you need to see more and more Republicans willing to take a public stand and willing to speak out. And you are starting to see that, you know, Lisa Murkowski, for example, and, Senator Collins and Senator Cory Gardner from Colorado, people who are up for re-election in 2020, obviously they're nervous politically, but that's how politics works, you know. People feel fearful for their re-election will actually alter their behavior sometimes. We need that at this point. I mean, given how horrible Trump's governance has been, plus just his just a steady erosion of democratic norms, I mean, we're going to need those 20 or so votes possibly to remove Trump from office at some point in the next 2 years. You know, I mean, that's not going to happen next week, but we're going to have to increasingly, I think in those terms.
Well, let's focus in, Will Bunch, on, I mentioned that on Friday is when the deadline for a lot of government workers to get their checks. And if the government shutdown goes down past Friday, they don't get their checks. And you had just mentioned earlier that if he does tomorrow declare a state of emergency, the government will open. Walk us through that. I'm not sure about how that mechanism would work.
Well, I mean, that might be an oversimplification, to be honest. I mean, I think there's a theory that it would reopen because, yeah, I mean, you would still need, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, you would still need legislation passed by both houses of Congress and signed by the president. The presumption is that the houses are willing to pass a resolution without a spending resolution without the border wall. And if Trump takes the border wall off the table by just saying, declaring an emergency, then, in theory, that would clear the way for this legislation. Here's the problem with that theory, though, is Democrats are going to be outraged if Trump declares a state of emergency. As we discussed earlier, I think many will view it the way that you and I seem to kind of view it, which is that it's a dictatorial or autocratic type move on behalf of the president. And I think you might see some Democrats say, in protest of the state of emergency, we're not going to make it easy for them. So I don't think that necessarily guarantees that the government stays open. I think that's the belief that could happen. Something's got to give because, like you said, these people won't be getting their checks. I mean, you're going to see, I think, increasing protests. I know there's a big protest, I think, scheduled for tomorrow in Washington by federal workers. And that's before the non-paycheck. One can only imagine afterwards. And I think you'd see other citizens joining in these protests, in communities where people aren't getting food stamps and other things. I don't know what type of protests would occur. I mean, there's a real potential here for chaos.
Right, but the more you talk about it, well, the more it seems to me that's exactly it would be Trump's strategy. He's obviously never had any check and balance on him until the Dems took over the House, and he obviously doesn't like the restraints that a real separate branch is bringing in terms of at least the House, not the Senate. The Senate is totally abdicated. So the fact that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have got him cornered, this is his way out. He declares a national emergency to get his wall and then opens up the government and then signs their bills. What can they do to stop him?
Right. And, well, I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure if he could also reopen the government by national emergency or not. I mean, that would be an interesting test case. I mean, what I am thinking, though, as we war game these scenarios is, like I said, I mean, if the government didn't reopen right away, and if he saw chaos or even, you know, heaven forbid, you know, say a riot somewhere or something, I mean, he certainly could seize on that. I mean, this is kind of the downward spiral, slippery slope situation that we've seen in other countries that have, you know, lapsed into severe dictatorship type situations. I'm talking about an absolute worst case scenario, but, you know, it's the potential here is alarming because with each passing day, it just seems like the chance of him actually reaching a agreement, you know, this guy who calls himself the master of the art of the deal, seems incapable of reaching any kind of true political compromise with people that he disagrees with. So it's kind of hard to see what the end game is here, except for something that's truly terrible.
Well, as he tweeted out today, though, that Nancy said no. So I said, bye-bye. Nothing else works. So that's why I think this is going to happen tomorrow. I think it's almost inevitable. But we are not in the prediction business, so don't hold me to it, okay?
No, but let's talk again soon, and we'll see how our theories play out. But hopefully there's somebody in the White House who's looking at the poll numbers and seeing this isn't playing well for the Republicans, and it's not playing well for the Republicans in Congress who are going to have to run for re-election in 2020, and it's definitely not playing well for Trump. You know, we already are seeing the majority of Americans blaming Trump or the Republicans for this government shutdown. So if you go by politics 101, somebody will see that and try and make a deal. But the thing is, nothing seems to be happening normally right now.
That is an understatement. I thank you for joining us, Will Bunch.
Thanks, Ian. Anytime. I enjoyed being on.
And again, I've been speaking with Will Bunch, who is an award-winning senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, and he blogs at attitude.com. That's attitywitood.com. He's the author of Tear Down This Myth, The Right-Wing Distortion of the Reagan Legacy. And his latest article at the Philadelphia Daily News is U.S. National Emergency Law, A Disaster Waiting for a Demagogue Like Trump. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.